Today, more from the property market front line, who's buying and who's selling. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined by Veronica Morgan. Hello, Veronica.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, great that you can spend some time with us. And, you know, virtual stuff works quite well when you're trying to do this sort of stuff. People will know you, of course, from the location. But also, you are the principal of, I think, a really interesting organisation who's really focusing on buyers.
Absolutely. I'm a principal of Good Deeds Property Buyers. So we're a Sydney-based buyers agency. And really our premise, if you like, or the reason that we exist is to help people buy a property without regrets. And I know you talk often about the sort of regrets that people might have if they buy the wrong property or they, well, it's really fundamentally the wrong property. It's more important than paying too much, to be quite frank. So yes, that's what we do. And also I think you're going to talk about the podcast too, aren't you?
I think we should give it a cross promote because you and Chris Bates have this wonderful series of podcasts running. In fact, I was on last week, and it's one of the go-to places to learn about property.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's the Elephant in the Room property podcast, and it started off with the whole premise of, well, the elephant is a metaphor for our subconscious mind, and psychologists will say that upwards of 80%, maybe as high as 95% of our decisions are made by our subconscious, not by our rational mind, despite our best intentions and despite often what we think. And so we started off the whole thing by interviewing a behavioral scientist who went off to an auction, their first ever auction, and came back and, oh my God, these people are just being influenced by all manner of things. And that has spurned, we're up to now 120 episodes or something in that ilk. It's been a fascinating journey because the reality is people think they're in control when they're buying property, but really and truly most of us are not.
Well, you have a little byline which basically says, who is really making the decisions when you buy property, right? And that suggests, there's somebody over there because I'm not in control.
Well, that's a shit. A lot of people think they're in control. And I think that we want to sort of put the spotlight on it. It's like, you think you are. But are you?
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's a bit of a psychological pressure cooker, especially when there's an auction going on and where you've got everybody else sort of being jollied along by the auctioneer and all of those sorts of things. So it's not totally rational, is it?
And not so much at this day and age, though, the age of COVID, because, of course, auctions are a slightly different beast than what they normally are. But I think that the psychology goes even further back. It goes into our psyche as Australians in terms of this indelible belief that property always goes up in value. And I know that you keep telling everybody that it doesn't, and it's true, it doesn't. You're not the only one that has to say this. And yet I'll still have people argue with me about it.
Well, you know, they do say, and it comes up in my surveys, every 7 years property prices double religiously, right? And that is a fixated belief. And of course, it's propagated by a lot of people in the real estate sector too, because it's good for them because they want transactions. But actually, it does very much depend on where you've bought, what you bought, when you bought it. And yeah, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. I mean, I've been through four property crashes now, some in the UK. Mm. And so I know what happens when you're on the other end and when, in fact, prices go down. And it's a horrible experience. And of course, it can take an awful long time to recover from those dips. You know, people are from the global financial crisis in the UK and in Ireland and the USA are still below the waterline. So, I think we probably have yet to really experience recently the sort of drops that probably we're facing now.
Yeah, but I think that the problem, of course, in, you know, talking about drops like that and the media, as you know, want to talk to you about, you know, what's Australian property going to do? And there is, as you know, no such thing as an Australian property market. There's not even a Sydney property market. There's not even, I mean, you know, where I'm in the inner west of Sydney, there's not even an inner west market. It's not even a suburb-driven market. There's certain patterns, obviously, but the reality is that the big decision comes down to when, particularly with investors, owners are different, owner-occupiers is a different conversation, but with investors, you know, the message that's been put out there to investors and what they've been buying en masse is mostly crap. And, you know, I would hazard and I haven't got accurate stats around this, so I can't literally say I've gone through every single investment property that's been bought in this country, but I would say my guess is 95% of it I wouldn't have touched.
Yeah.
Probably higher.
Very interesting. And, of course, a lot of that will be relatively newly constructed high-rise, often constructed to a budget and looking a bit worse for wear perhaps a few years afterwards. But the main thing is it's like there are thousands and thousands and thousands of similar type properties, right?
Yes.
And so if you are in the sort of process of thinking of selling and you're one of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 all doing the same at the same time and all offering pretty much, it's an apartment, it's in a high rise, it's, you know, it's okay, but it's not flash. They will be the problem areas, won't they?
Well, it's a race to the bottom then, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, if that one over there is on the market and that one over there is on the market and that one's 50 grand cheaper than that one, well, I'm going to go the one 50 grand cheaper. Or I might even be smart enough to go, why would I buy in that building at all, given that there's so many that are all very similar? And so the smart buyer won't touch it even as a secondhand sale, even if it's considered a bargain, because they've got to think, well, what happens next time when I go to sell? There's always going to be a whole number of them in that building for sale. So there's so many different elements that are important there to consider. But so scarcity is obviously one of the build qualities you've touched on is another. It's also that building may have no scarcity, but what about the other 10 that are as part of that huge development that could take another decade to actually be complete? So this, and I think Brisbane is a good example of how people have actually invested, and I use that word advisedly because they haven't actually invested. They've willfully, wishfully thrown their money away. It's not the, is there a word for that? Gambled, perhaps, but not even then. You know, it's the odds are so against them. But so, and then 10 years later, they're worse off than they started, and that's before you even factor in opportunity cost.
Absolutely. You know, I was talking to somebody some weeks ago who owns a boat, and he said, you know, there's a much quicker way to lose money than owning a boat, and that is you take your money and you basically flush it down the toilet, right? Yeah. And I have a feeling that some property investors these days are somewhat in a similar boat. I can tell you better ways to lose money, but actually, if you do the calculations and if you take account of the, you know, the money in and the money out, even with all the tax breaks, a lot of people are underwater before they start.
Yeah.
And it's only been the capital appreciation that they hold to as being the thing that might come good. But of course, if it doesn't, then the property investment sort of philosophy really doesn't work, does it?
Well, on the boat thing, by the way, at least you get to enjoy it. When you buy a unit in Brisbane, if you live in Sydney or Melbourne, and you're not even yourself enjoying it. But, yeah, it's look, at the end of the day, what so many people say is that it went up in value, and that's assuming it did, and they're basically not wanting to really recognise that actually property does lose value. I mean, CoreLogic releases a report every quarter called Pain and Gain Report, and that roughly 10%, give or take, of Australian property every quarter loses money in terms of its sale price. That doesn't count the holding cost. It doesn't count the cost, the actual acquisition cost and the exit cost. It doesn't count the opportunity. It doesn't cost, it doesn't count renovation improvements. I would hazard maybe it could be 30, 40% perhaps that actually, who knows actually how much has actually lost money once you take those things into account. And then there's how much is sitting there that if they did sell it today would sell for less than they sold it yesterday. So this problem, given that the 10% is a very, it's a very small percentage of the actual stock that's out there in the country, it's a very, very big problem. And so there's people that think that they're investing and they bury their head in the sand, but there's also the people that say, oh, I've done really well in property, and I always like to ask, how have you measured that? And it's like, oh, I made money. And I said, relative to what? You know, what's your benchmark? But it went up. Yes. And it's amazing how many very, very successful, very, very smart, very educated people actually will say that, and it's the first time they've ever been questioned. And of course, then they go, oh, yeah, never even dawned on me. And that is alarming.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And, you know, I survey households all the time, and I find this you know, almost always when you talk to property investors and you realize that they really have done very little, they've sort of, they think it's an automatic wealth creation exercise, right? So basically I buy on day one, I get the tax breaks from the government through negative gearing, I sit there and let the property appreciate in value, and 20 years later, I'm going to be rich.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, you know, the dream. Unfortunately, the reality is not necessary. And well, it's the thing
is a bigger dream. There's a bigger dream. There's the people who have bought their house and land package, been told that it's going to go up, you know, the valuation will come in at a lot more than it's cost you within 2 years, and then you can borrow again in the equity because you've made money, and then you can do it all over again and buy in the next subdivision.
Yeah, and that whole cross leverage, and you know, by one, by two, by three, by 10. I mean, I survey again property investors. Some of them have got 10, 15, 20 properties, and they all are okay if things go up. But if they start to go down, then that's when the pain is multiplied. And unfortunately, we see quite a few of those who are being forced to sell. And of course, the point to make about property, it's illiquid, isn't it? Right? Because you've got to go through a particular process to get shot of it, and you need a buyer, or someone would say a greater fool, to come in and take it off your hands.
Yeah, well, it takes a lot less time to buy a property than it does to sell one, even if you've got a good one, really. And so that's just something that people just forget. They just seem to, or maybe they've never been through it, I don't know. But it's I guess it's funny because I you know, I was a sales agent originally, and so, and really where my whole philosophy came about property came about observing that some properties are easy to sell in a slow market and some properties are hard to sell in a slow market, and then but in a hot market they're all easy to sell. And you think, oh, well, that's interesting. There's got to be something in that, isn't there? And so you start thinking, okay, well, what makes an A-grade property? What makes a property that sells regardless of market conditions? And they do exist. They absolutely do exist. And that's where that scarcity comes into it. And it, and some people say, oh, yeah, but they're the multi-million dollar mansions. You know, they'll always say, no. It's the bell curve of buyer demand, basically. We're going for maximum appeal to a maximum, you know, multiple buyer groups within the sort of, a robust price bracket where a lot of people have got access to that sort of money. And, you know, they're great properties to buy. You've got to understand exactly what those are, where they are, firstly where they are, and then what they look like.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And we keep saying, and I say it again, not all property is the same, you know. It's units versus houses, location, all of those things, and location, location, location. I mean, it is part of the story, isn't it?
It's part of it, but not all of it. And I think this is, it's banged on a bit, you know, part for the show, of course. But it's the reason, I guess, the show was called that was because everyone believes this. It's this sort of unquestioned belief around property, but it's not actually the truth. It's a bit like saying, I'll buy the worst house in the best street. It's like, sort of, but... best street where, you know, and there's just so much digging that has to be done that I just don't think people, I think it's very complex buying property, and I don't think people are critical enough.
No, well, I think that's right. And perhaps to illustrate that, what I'd like to do is perhaps go into a few thumbnails, right? A lot of people write to me and send me messages via the YouTube channel, and, you know, I can boil them back into four or five different archetypal, you know, behavioral types and, you know, different life cycles and those things. And maybe I wouldn't mind exploring some of those. So the first one I want to touch on is the first-time buyer who's saved up their 10 or 15% deposit, right? And they're now watching what's happening with regard to the market. They see the government's 95% scheme there, and they see all of the first-time buyer incentives that are out there. What would you say to a potential first-time buyer at this stage in the cycle?
Can I have a little plug here? Because I'm actually developing a whole new business designed to help first home buyers. So it's homebuyeracademy.com.au. There's actually a free little course on there to how to price a property right now. But even before you get to that, the problem with first home buyers or the risk with first home buyers is that basically they are the fuel underneath the whole market in a way, right? So they got to buy the entry-level stuff. Now, a lot of entry-level stuff is stuff that they'll be stuck with forever if they're not careful. And what I mean there is that because new developments are heavily pitched towards first home buyers, and that is apartments and house and land packages, because governments want to encourage first home buyers to buy those sorts of property with their stamp duty concessions and the government grants, then first home buyers think that that's their only way into a market. And what they don't often realise is it's the only way into a, I think you call it a mortgage, what do you call it? Mortgage.
Mortgage prisoners.
Mortgage prison, yeah. And the risks of a property obviously not gaining value, let alone losing value, in areas where there's just ongoing subdivisions or ongoing new development is extraordinarily high. And this is what first home buyers don't realise. They just sold this myth that you just got to get on the ladder, get on the ladder. If your first rung on that ladder is cracked, shaky, rotten, you are never going to go anywhere on that ladder. And in fact, you could get buried. And this is one, it's a big passion of mine. And I realise that I'm fighting a juggernaut here. The whole economy of this country is really, I mean, it's a single big, property is the single biggest investment class in this country. I'm a property person. Everyone thinks I'm a bull, you know, but I think we're here to find out I'm not. That the first home buyers and silly investors are really the fodder for something that's much bigger than all of us, and that is our economy. And so for first home buyers, need to understand that where they buy is critical. You know, so there's lots of different schools of thought here as to whether they should buy a house that they can then add to down the track, or whether they should buy an apartment and then upgrade. And that answer to those questions is very different for different individuals. But what I want to do is steer them well away from the new stock. Well away from new stock. And certainly, you know, this, or even this dream of rent vesting, you know, it's like using negative gearing. And I'm more for negative gearing if it's used properly. But, you know, where, you get all these depreciations and you don't have to, it's for the price of a cup of coffee, you too can own a property. There's just so many false promises. So I think first home buyers, they may be coming into a period of opportunity, of course, because if you know, if all you doomsdayers, you know, Martin, are correct about the property market is going to fall in a hole and 20, 30, 40% declines in value. And once again, that won't be everywhere, it won't be uniform. But if there are solid blue chip areas where basically prices do start falling and affordability does start improving, then there will be opportunities for first home buyers, but they just need to focus on buying really good quality stock in really good areas, and they'll be fine and they can take advantage of these potentially, you know, the conditions that may come. So there's opportunity there for first home buyers, but a big warning.
Yeah, and I just want to underscore that buying off the plan, buying new, it's like buying a new car. When you buy a new car, you know, as soon as you drive it out the garage the first time, you've lost value. Mm. And very often, if you're buying off the plan, you know, the expectation maybe of the price will have gone up in the meantime, but almost always you've got all the extras and, you know, all of the bells and whistles. So you're actually buying in at probably a more accelerated price than you should. And then you risk losing so much so quickly. So I'm always very nervous about people saying, I'm going to buy off the plan for those very reasons.
Mm. Well, investors, I mean, this is the thing investors often don't think about. I mean, there's a lot of all the spruikers and the developers, and they're quite happy to push the stamp duty, the stamp duty benefits of first home buyers, but obviously the negative gearing benefits and the depreciation. You can depreciate this because it's brand new. Hmm. And then it's like, and if you have to sell it, it won't be brand new anymore. And even if it's a year old and there's a building next door that's just been completed, they get full depreciation and yours won't. And who is the investor going to go? Well, which one is the investor? And the next dumb investor, I say dumb, Dumbo investor, which is the next Dumbo investor going to go and buy? They're going to buy the one with all the depreciation and pay a premium for it. So, yeah, it's pretty horrible, because it seems, it's always packaged up so it seems so attractive, but it's really quite unattractive.
Mm, absolutely. Well, let me go on to a different thumbnail. Now, this is quite often I get, you know, this maybe a household that's 55 towards 60, you know, beginning to think about, you know, retiring at some point, sitting in quite a large property with quite a lot of equity in it. They perhaps bought it, you know, a few years ago. But they're now hearing that there is a risk that prices might fall. And so the question is, should they try to get out quickly and get as much of the equity as they actually can? Or should they sit there and wait and hope that things don't fall too far so that they can sell later? How would you think about that?
Well, see, here's the thing with downsizers, okay? If they have a property that actually is attractive in the current market, then their decision-making is going to be very different to somebody who maybe has a house that's, say, 40 years old that really needs to be either fully renovated or demolished or whatever. And there are a lot of suburban areas in Sydney where the stock, the predominant stock, is very dated, and, you know, the new generation moving in sort of, you know, I have to, they want to renovate it. So buying an apartment, so downsizing, so selling the big old family home and buying an apartment in the same suburb, there might be no change. Those buyers, they really do better in, well, to be quite honest, they've sort of trapped themselves too in a way. But they do better in a rising market. If you've got an asset that's bigger than the one you're buying, then typically, and these are sort of blanket statements, they do better in a rising market because, of course, if your house is worth $1 million and you're buying an apartment worth 900 and the whole market's going up 10%, then obviously the gap's getting bigger. That's theoretical. To some degree, it plays out. Obviously, the downsizers want to take, upgraders want to take advantage of a falling market. Very few are brave enough to, because they really fixate on their sale price, not the transfer price. And it's a really tough thing for most people to get over, that emotional pull. But, yeah, for the downsizers, you know, I wouldn't be in a screaming hurry unless you're really, 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 really ready.
Yeah, because they've got time on their side in a way. And, you know, unless you are really going to hit a deadline where you have to do something, I think flexibility is probably a good thing at the moment.
There are some downsizers that have bought off the plan, though.
I know.
I've seen that.
Yeah. I've actually seen, again, in my surveys, you know, people who've sold their rather large property and they've bought a smaller one off the plan and then bought an investment property. Mm. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure that's necessarily the smartest move.
Yeah,
it's tricky, but you know, unfortunately, that's often because a lot of people are looking at the equity in their property as essentially part of their retirement savings.
Mm.
And unfortunately, with superannuation going down, you know, at the moment with where the markets are and the fact that perhaps property growth won't be there, I think many people are going to move into retirement probably with a bigger mortgage than they thought they had and probably less equity than they thought they had. So it's a tricky time for, I think, that particular group.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, yes, so I'm not sure. I think a lot of downsizers, if they're smart, will probably just sit and write it out.
Okay. So here's another thumbnail, and this is the one that I'm, you know, really uncomfortable about talking about, but I think we should. So this, quite often property investors bought 2 or 3 years ago, you know, in the new high-rises. They're starting to see a few cracks, not major cracks, but sort of, you know, superficial cracks on the outside of the building, and they're a bit worried about what they should do. Now, we've already said earlier on, it probably wasn't the smartest transaction you ever did, but what should they do? I mean, if they're in a situation where they're in this, you know, they've got this unit, maybe it's an investment property, tricky, I think, very tricky to know what to do.
It's really hard because, of course, we've got this thing called loss aversion, where we don't like to realise a loss. Mm. We'd rather not do anything about it, pretend we're not making a loss. Yeah, it's funny. I developed a methodology a couple of years ago to try to assess the asset quality or calibre of asset of any property in Australia. And so I sort of broke it down into flyers, floaters or flops, right? So a flyer is, you know, if the median, you know, you could say the median of Australia, then you could break it down the median into capital cities and the median suburbs, et cetera, et cetera. So you really want a property that's going to outperform the rest, really. If everything goes up 10%, you want yours to go up 12-13%. If everything goes up 1%, you want yours to go up 1.5%. If everything falls, you want to be falling less than everything else. I mean, it's just that relativity that's really important. So the flyers, you obviously want to own regardless. You want to keep that. You want to do everything you can to keep a flyer because it's going to outperform everything else. A floater, you know, you depending on your situation, where you are in life, you might decide to hold on to a floater. If you had a floater at the very beginning of your investment journey, you've got a 20-30 year runway, then that's costing you But if you got a floater and you're 50 and you're thinking you want to retire in 15 years, by the time you spend the money selling it, buying again, all that sort of stuff and reinvesting, you might as well just left it and let it do its thing. The flop, however, a flop is just pure cost in one form or another. Often in numerous forms, a flop is a pure cost. And as I said earlier, you know, probably 95% of property in Australia that investors buy wouldn't touch with a barge pole. So therefore, probably 95% of property in Australia that investors own is flops. Then you got to look at, okay, is it ever going to gain value? You know, is it just going to sit there draining? You know, is it actually going to lose money? Is it going to gain value, but at a really, really small rate? So therefore, why bother holding it? So when you sort of start to be really a bit more, I guess, critical in the way you actually look at your own investment decisions, and that's tough because people don't want to admit they made a mistake. So what this really came to light really at the end of, I think it was 2016, when the, you know, the APRA's credit crunch came in, and we had a lot of our clients that wanted to upgrade their family home or renovate their family home and couldn't because they were hamstrung by some of these crap investment properties they bought before they came knocked on our door. And it's like, right, well, you're going to make some decisions because now that stuff that before didn't, you felt like it wasn't costing you anything, or for the price of a cup of coffee a day, you know, it wasn't costing you anything. Now it's costing you your life, you know, your lifestyle. This is actually costing you getting on with life the way you want to live it. Now you're starting to see actually the real impact of not, and you're lucky you're seeing it early rather than in 20 years' time when you go to retire. So that's sort of what brought it to a spotlight, the fact we couldn't continue just keep borrowing anymore. And so I guess fundamentally people got to be really honest with themselves. Have they bought themselves a dud? And the dud won't become good. It's not, oh, I've got to wait for it to make money. No, if it's a dud, it's a dud. And duds don't turn in from ducklings to swans. And I think that's probably what people are holding on to often when they avoid making these decisions. So it's really that hold hard, that really hard thing to do, rip the Band-Aid off, get the hell out of there if you've got a dud.
And just sort of to help people understand, what are the symptoms of a dud? What are the things you'd look for to say that's a dud?
Yeah, the symptoms of a dud, well, there's that scarcity thing for starters. If there are lots in that building and they're all the same. And the other thing too, one of the other issues is when you buy into a new complex or a new subdivision, you and everyone else have bought it pretty much the same time. You know, if you've bought it along with another bunch of investors, you've all leased it out at the same time. You've probably got somewhat similar financial situation. You borrowed all the same amount of money at the same time. All your loans are going to come up for renewal at the interest-only periods and all the rest of it at the same time. So there's a lot of that pressure in that you've got a lot of other neighbours with exactly the same pressures as you. And so you've got to be thinking, if all this stuff hit the market at the same time, we're going to find another bunch of buyers like us to come along. Some of the other signs are, you know, if you went to a real estate agent and said, how quick, you know, what price would it take to sell this in 2 weeks? You know, that agent starts fidgeting and fumbling and all that sort of stuff. I don't really want your listing. If the agent says I don't want your listing, you know, then you know you've got yourself a dud. But if they basically give you, if you say I am desperate, you know, not that you'd ever say this to an agent, but if you went to an agent, if I was absolutely desperate, if I needed that money, how much do I need to sell it for? How much do I need to list it for to sell it? That's going to give you a clue. How many different types of buyers would like the property? You know, one bedrooms with no parking on a busy road. You know, it's like you just got to apply a bit of common sense. You know, people think, oh, tenants love it. It's like, yeah, but the tenant can move out easily. The next person who buys it, you want to be an owner-occupier. Would an owner-occupier want to buy that? No. Oh, well, there you go. That's another thing that says to me, no, you got a dud. So there's all those sorts of questions that you need to be asking yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's always a question beyond the question, right? Because obviously people sometimes jump into decisions a bit too quick and don't do the calculus. Mm. And I think it's even more important now, because the other factor that's just worth touching on for a second is, you know, we had strong migration for a good number of years. The migration is really notches right down at the moment. So in terms of future demand for property, my expectation is that property investors probably, you know, taking to the sidelines. There are still some first-time buyers who are around, but not a huge number. We don't have the international investors that we had. So the prognosis going forward for the market, you know, I struggle to see where the buyers are going to come from.
It is sort of interesting. I mean, yes, there's been overseas investors, but they've predominantly been in that new space. So I guess I don't sort of on the ground see too much activity from overseas investors.
Okay.
I think also that you've got this situation with the short-term investor as well. And so Airbnb and the inability to actually have your property available for Airbnb has actually created a lot more supply as well. So it would be interesting to see some data around this, because the reality is that I don't think we have a true handle on whether we've got an oversupply or undersupply problem at all. You know, I think it's been very much masked by the fact we've had an unofficial hotels, you know, whole segment of the hotel market that has actually been residential property, which hasn't been counted as residential property. And so yeah, I don't, just not quite certain, you know, where these numbers are going to come from. Maybe CoreLogic's got access to something like that. I don't know. But it will be interesting if we can start to see some breakdown of actually what is available to be lived in on a permanent basis.
Well, certainly I've got data in my surveys from people who've switched from Airbnb type investing to looking for a long-term tenant, right? And they're having to take a 30 or 40% haircut on the typical rental that they get because of it, right? The other interesting thing there is, if you look at the ABS data, they actually, last time they ran a census, said there's about 1 million properties who are vacant across Australia. So I'm not sure that we actually have an undersupply of property at the aggregate level, maybe in particular postcodes we do, but there does seem to be quite a lot of spare property around. And then we've still got another 200,000 new units coming on stream at the moment, you know, because the construction is still happening, and we've got our 1 million construction workers still supporting the economy and all of those things. So there is still a lot of pressure to build more, build more, build more. But I have to say, I'm not quite sure precisely who's going to be buying. And I come back to that, you know, supply demand is a lot of what drives property prices and price discovery. And if in fact the number of people with property is higher than the people who want to buy property, then that tells you that there's perhaps more downside than upside on property prices. You know, and I think I told you the other day, I run multiple scenarios, you know, from a significant fall to, you know, a slight adjustment. So it does, I think, depend so many variable moving parts. But I come back to this sort of, you know, final point, I guess. It seems to me that the property market is highly manipulated. It's manipulated by the government through the tax system. It's manipulated by the construction sector because they want to sell, you know, new stuff and create economic momentum. Obviously, all the states benefit from the stamp duty and those sorts of things too. And the real estate industry itself is very much in the business of getting people to buy. I sometimes wonder who real estate agents actually work for. That's maybe an interesting comment too.
Another
on the
topic.
Way the industry works. Yeah. well, particularly now when, of course, the volumes of transactions are way down on where they were. But I guess people need to understand that this is not a pure, you know, supply demand thing. It's a very complicated and a very manipulated market.
Well, it is, and the problem is also a couple of things that you left out the media, because let's face it, the two biggest portals and media are intrinsically linked. You've also got a situation where, look, I've been a bit embarrassed to call myself a real estate agent of recent times, because some of the commentary and some of the talk out of sales agents' mouths is shocked me. It's just complete fear driven. You know, they're talking, they're scaring people into selling, they're scaring. It's phenomenal. And a part of that is their own hip pocket, and they're not used to not being able to earn commissions. And look, I am a real estate agent. I get it. I get that. But unfortunately, what they do forget, and this is, we all play part in this, right? I have never met one homeowner who said, okay, Joe or Janine, real estate agent, I'm going to give you $30,000 fee for service, whether you sell my property or not, because I want you to give me the right advice. I haven't met anyone who does that. And so sales agent comes and says, well, I'm going to charge you 1.5%, 2%, whatever of the actual sales price. And Janine, or sorry, the client says, oh, that's good, because the more my price, my property goes up, and about the higher you sell my price, my property for, the more money you get. But 1.5%, 2% of an extra 20 grand is not much. But everyone forgets, everyone blames a real estate agent, but everyone forgets that they don't really want to pay that agent for advice. You know, they want to pay for an outcome. Well, the outcome means that if you choose not to sell your property, that agent doesn't get anything. So he's, it doesn't take, you know, a genius to work out. The agent is going to do what they can do to get you to sell. And it's the system.
It is the system, exactly right. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes people in the cold light of the morning after it's all over think, what just happened there?
Yes. And it's true, though, because the thing is the agent actually does it day in, day out, you know, and the individual seller or the individual buyer doesn't do it day in, day out. But we all think we can, you know, it's funny. Everyone says, oh, you've got to get an agent to sell your property. And I still do think an agent does a better job than most people selling their property. Mm-hmm. But no one actually thinks, oh, God, this is too complex, so I need to get an agent on the buying side. They go, oh, I can do this. I'm good at negotiating. It's like they're so unmatched. They're unmatched by somebody who's hungrier than them probably.
Yeah, and you know, the truth is that you probably will buy what, maybe 3, 4, 5 times in your whole life. So you don't really have a huge track record of understanding all the dynamics, whereas in fact you'll be dealing with people who are doing it week in, week out, and therefore it's a very unequal battle. Okay,
they've also got more information than you've got, you know, so even if they're not that experienced, they still do know more than you do about that vendor's circumstances and other buyers. So yeah, it is uneven.
So I guess I wanted to ask two final questions. The first question is, when somebody thinks about a property and a location, right, where is the best place to go for, you know, granular information? Because you can't just take the top level indices, you know, for Sydney or whatever, right? You got to get much more granular than that. So what's the sort of the best source in terms of trying to get some of that more granular information?
It's really hard, but it really is hard because there are so many buyer's agents there that sort of become data houses, you know, that they just basically aggregate data and they whip it into shape in a way that sort of fits their story and, you know, and then that's what they'll push. And I think when it comes to data and information with property, it's so easily manipulated to tell whatever story you want that I look to it, but I steer clear of it simultaneously, if that makes sense. I look to it to ratify whether I'm making good decisions. What I actually look to, and I actually think that property investing is really is an elite sport in the sense that it's a bit like what's really yachting, perhaps. You have to be able to afford to buy a bloody good yacht in order to probably win the race. You know, the right sales, the right crew, it costs a lot of money to win the Sydney and Hobart. It's probably a really bad analogy. I've never ever done it this way before. But the fact is that when you're buying investment property, you need a good income because I don't believe you should buy for yield ever. I think you've got to buy for capital growth, but you can't buy, you know, hoping for capital growth. You have to buy looking for the fundamentals. The fundamentals are that if you are going to be, you have to be close to a metropolis. The only two metropolises in Australia that really have all those economic foundations are Sydney and Melbourne. So, okay, so you've got it down to two cities. Then you've got to go, right, well, within those two cities, how close to the metropolis do I need to be and why? You know, it's basically the knowledge centres and service industries, et cetera, et cetera. So you go, well, ideally 5Ks from the CBD, ideally. We'll go to 10. But really 5. And this is purely for investor, of course. And then you got to say, okay, well, within those 5Ks, what in each of those suburbs, what constitutes the premium property in those locations? Because not everything will do well. Some properties will actually lose money while others are making money, you know, even in those blue chip suburbs. So the location itself is not enough if you haven't actually worked out what the characteristics of the properties in those areas that actually appeal to the, you know, multiple buyer groups, then you're gonna fail. So it's sort of, so all of my research over the years, and I've done it over and over again, and I just keep coming back to the same fundamentals, that inner ring in the two biggest cities, and within that inner ring, you've got to look for where you've got underlying demand for the type of property from multiple buyer groups, regardless of market conditions. And then you've got the sort of reverse ripple effect happening too. So you've got that, you know, everyone talks about the ripple effect and buying the next suburb that's going to come along, that's going to gentrify, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes those suburbs do gentrify and then stay gentrified. But often what happens is that they gentrify, all right, but they're always the second best to a better suburb. It's the better suburb, because then you always get someone else who couldn't previously afford it will always go and look there when market goes south. And that's why they're buffered and somewhat insulated. So, but within those suburbs, you've got to understand what local buyers want and what they will pay for and what they value. And this is where people get it wrong. They think it's just a suburb and that's enough.
Yeah, and it's way more complicated, I think, than people think, which, of course, is one of the critical points. And I guess then the last question for you, Veronica, is what is the one piece of advice that you would give to somebody thinking about property at the current point in time?
Get ready so that you can then choose to do something or not to do something. If you're not ready, then you've only got one option, that's to do nothing. Or you need you could do something stupid. And when I say get ready, it's not just getting finance and all that in place, get your house in order. It's actually get yourself educated. Get yourself, if you're looking to buy a home, you've got to really fully understand what it is that you need in a home, what you want in a home for now, for the future, how long you want to be in that home, where you want to live, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what you want your life to look like. You've got to understand all of that stuff. Rather than just, I've got to get home. And quite often people are pressured by what's bothering them now. And I'm sure in COVID, there'd be a lot of things bothering people about their homes. So you've got to be thinking about definitely a long-term, look 10 years at least ahead, because people aren't looking long enough ahead. And so that's part of getting ready, is really preparing, understand what it is you need, and then research the market. Look at recent history to see where does the stock exist that you'd want to buy, and what is it selling? What has it been selling for? And if it falls, great. And if it goes, I'm not sure anything's going to go up in the short term. But, you know, at some point in some of these areas, there's still scarcity and there's still demand. So there's pockets that will go up. So it's really understanding what your possibilities are so that you then have the choice, you have the option at the time when we all know actually what is going to happen.
Mm. Look, I really appreciate your time today, Veronica. Thank you very much. It's been really very exhilarating listening to you and talking with you about the property sector, because you clearly know it really well. And I think you've made some excellent points for our viewers. So thanks for your time today. And maybe I can beg another favour down the track and get you to come back and talk a bit more.
Pleasure. You know, you can't shut me up once you get me going.
Excellent. Those are the sorts of guests I like. Thanks
Thank
for your
you,
time.
Martin.
Okay.
See ya.
Thanks. Bye-bye.